In the Thick of It, a Profit and Loss podcast with Colin Lambert and Galen Stobbs.
Welcome to In the Thick of It, Profit and Losses podcast. And this week we're putting the band back together. We got Galen back. So after ruthlessly abandoning me to the brutality of Julie's questioning last week about socks, normal service has been resumed and our sound engineers will be very pleased to hear we're not sitting by a pool. We don't have yapping dogs in the background. It's just us in two nicely soft furnished rooms. So, Galen, welcome back. How are you doing?
Thank you. Yeah, good. I'm, rested, relaxed, and raring to go as we enter the silly season.
And I'm jealous. Yeah. Okay, so I thought we'd kick off this week looking at our sort of swing through Asia again with our conferences. There was something really interesting in the Global Code panel in Singapore, where a corporate client just turned around and sort of made some interesting observations around enforcing the code.
Yeah.
Basically,
So the question was posed to a corporate who was sitting on the panel, kind of discussing the code, and then the question was, in reality, even if it's 6 months from now, a year from now, if one of your counterparties isn't adhering to the Global Code of Conduct, would you be willing to stop transacting with that counterparty? Because we've talked before about how it has teeth and what it's going to require for the code to kind of be adhered to, and a lot of people have said it's got to come from the kind of the end user to the buy side firm to the sell side firm to kind of really drive this thing. And so, I was asking a question, would you put pressure on your counterparties to the point where you'd, threaten to stop dealing with them if they don't adhere to the Global Code of Conduct? And the response was that while they like that idea and like being able to, big proponent of the code, the reality is, they said, that most corporates, rely on their banks heavily for so many services, and they only deal with, one or two, just a very few banks. So, they said that most corporates actually don't have that luxury of being able to say, hey, you need to behave in this way and you need to adhere to this code or I'm going to stop trading with you. And to my mind, that was kind of an interesting moment of honesty and kind of an interesting perhaps challenge for the code going forward. What are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, the only thing I would say is I think the code, I spoke when we wrote about this earlier this year to the chair of the European Association of Corporate Treasurers. And his point on this was very much that the global code will enable, if corporates do adopt the code, really for them it's around business practices, governance, continuity. So it's not necessarily around the market participation angle. But one thing he said to me that struck with me was very much like he said, the code allows corporates to ask questions about their execution. So, yeah, I think our speaker in Singapore was right in what they said. But what I would say is that if they're suspicious of, one or more of their LP providers' behaviour, they can at least ask a question publicly, i.e. at a high level in the firm, which would raise the issue in the sell-side institution. So whilst it wouldn't, they can't sort of have that ultimate sanction of saying, I'm not going to deal with you anymore, they can still ask the question. And I think that's quite important. The other thing I would probably say on that... Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, who are they asking the question to? To the bank themselves? Or the counterpart they're dealing with?
Yeah, I mean, I would suggest that we now live in an era in which if the corporate treasurer phoned up the COO or the global head of institutions at a bank and said, I'm a little bit worried about what's going on in your foreign exchange business. We're not happy with how you're dealing with us. Whilst that head of institutions will know, or a board level, it could even be a board level, whilst they would know that the corporate couldn't walk away from them, they sure as hell don't want that publicity out there. And if something does come out that has gone wrong, this would come out with it. So I think the very threat of a sniff of misbehaviour or bad practice will now be jumped on. It may not be done at desk level, although I think actually it will probably. I think most people who work on desks now understand that they can't mess around with this stuff. But I don't think, maybe if they're not getting the answers at desk level, then they'll get them at senior levels. And if there's one thing about dealers... Yeah, like, well, let's face it,
They couldn't have asked these questions before, though.
They could have done, but they probably weren't even, they probably weren't even aware that some of this stuff was going on. I mean, honestly, I don't think corporates will ask these questions because, generally speaking, there are a few exceptions to the rule, but if you look at it, 5% of turnover is corporate flow. The only time I think corporates will really get into their banks is if they think there's something funny going on in the forwards. Spot-wise, as long as they can get a TCA report, they can get a decent, they can use an algo, they can get a risk transfer, they can do whatever they like, and generally speaking, I think they can actually, get a good enough job done for them, because these guys are not necessarily looking to save every single cent. If they slip a couple of pips on an order, they probably don't care. They take it into account. So I think it's more for them a question around, they would be more concerned if someone was messing around with their FX swap business, maybe with some of the information that they're getting from the trade. But I think, to me, I still think we exist in a world. Maybe I'm a blind optimist, but I think we exist in a world whereby a call to the appropriate level in an institution will trigger a response. My concern is still the buy side. It's interesting. We've fallen into the trap again of talking about the sell side misbehaving. Yet I would say if you look at the firms signing up, the sell side have been very quick to sign up to this. And yes, of course, the sell side, as we've said several times on this podcast, were the main instigators of the misdemeanors. But I also think that we've fallen into the trap of, let's make sure the sell side doesn't do anything wrong, and we're ignoring the buy side implications. I was speaking to someone yesterday, and they're saying, I don't really get what the point of the code is. And I said, it's there to establish a framework that everyone can work to. And he said, but the buy side aren't going to use that. Just straight out.
Yeah.
And he didn't even think about it. He said, the buy side, and he was thinking asset managers, which is his background. He said, they're just not going to use this. And, you've got to say, probably there's a point there because, WM benchmark is a reference rate, yet the asset manager suddenly wanted to start trading it, and the banks allowed them to do it. So there is a history there of them not really caring. They have their own internal fiduciary requirements and their own internal guidelines, and they're happy to work to those, which goes back to our asset manager in Chicago who said pretty much the same thing. Do I need another one of these?
Yeah. So, and this kind of actually, to my mind, this plays into your recent column, where a few things you talked about. One was actually another point that kind of got raised in Singapore, but was kind of the different treatment of LPs and LCs on platforms.
I mean, that was a real eye-opener to me. You've effectively got people saying, we'll treat our LPs and our LCs differently. We have a different set of rules for them. The LCs can pretty much do what they like, and the LPs, we're going to clamp down on them. Again, this is buying into the whole story of the sell-side misbehaviour, which I think is probably outdated.
Well, for those who haven't read the column, Colin goes into a lot more detail on this, but it was an interesting point. Again, at our Singapore conference, Colin was moderating and the panel had some platforms on it. And Colin was talking about, they were talking about they hold their LPs to such high standards and they have to have these fill rates and response times, etc. And Colin kind of turned around and said, okay, are there rules for liquidity consumers that they have to adhere to? And the response there was basically no. And it was like, well, why not? And it was like, well, there's a price for everyone, and
if the LC doesn't like the price, they don't trade it. There's a point to that. I mean, the only thing I've got to correct you on is actually I wasn't moderating this one. I was just asking questions from the audience. I know. Just for full disclosure for our listeners, I'd hate to breach our own global code, which doesn't exist, in case you're wondering, listeners. I think what got me was, as you said there. So we hold our LPs to high standards, and we really check on their reject ratios. Blood, we do all this, we do all that, and liquidity consumers, kind of we let them do what they like. I mean, what to me the really interesting thing was that. So when they're also, so supposing the liquidity consumer is trading aggressively and maybe predatory and maybe even disruptively, and there was a shrug of the shoulders, you know, metaphorical shrug of the shoulders from the platform providers on the panel going like, well, you know, that's up to the LC to complain about it and do something about it. And like, I think, well, hang on a second. So you're moderating one side of the market. You're regulating one side of the market. Regulate is the wrong word, obviously. And then the other one, you're saying, well, actually, it's not my concern to talk to these people. It's you all of a sudden.
Yeah. And I mean, again, I don't, if you're doing the argument, okay, they don't have to trade on this price and there's a price for everyone and some people will have different tolerance levels, and that's fine. You could equally make that the same way, right? If someone has, there's some people who are going to be price sensitive but not fill sensitive, so they don't actually care if an LP has, you know, much higher reject rates as long as they're getting great pricing. You could kind of make the argument, if you're going to make that argument one way, I feel like you could just as equally make that argument the other, which is, you know, no one has to trade with one another, then everybody will find a price level and a reject level that's comfortable for them, and if it's not, go and trade somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is, firstly, I mean, you know, a platform provider will never turn away volume, because that's their lifeblood. But I think the interesting thing for me is, when you're looking at the sort of execution style of these things, we need to kind of try and work out what represents disruptive trading behavior. Because, you know, I've said before on this podcast, and it was said on the panel, some customers like market impact. For them, it's alpha. It's a source of alpha. You know, if I'm a speculative hedge fund, I'm going to go and I'm going to bang the market. I want some bang for my buck. And if I can, you know, I obviously want the market to move in my direction, but if I can get myself a very cheap 3 or 4 points just through my execution style, then that's 3 or 4 points that I'm going to earn for my investors. Now, the question is, and maybe this is a question going forward that the Global Foreign Exchange Committee has to consider, and they're meeting, I think, as we speak, they are actually meeting in Paris today. But I think the question we might have to consider is, what constitutes disruptive behavior? Does deliberately going after, does deliberately trying to achieve market impact create disruptive markets? Because to my mind, I look at it and go like, yeah, really? So it moves 3 or 4 points. I'm from a different generation when you can go out there and hit, you can go out there and hit someone. I mean, I work, you know, I work for a customer who, when we had to execute large risk, our execution style meant that the market would move, and it would move 60 or 70 points. I mean, sometimes we destroyed people, and we had no choice. There was nothing else we could do due to our execution policy. But nowadays, we're talking about 3 or 4 pips. But if that happens on a regular basis, and you don't get that 3 or 4 pips back, and with the data that's available to the LPs now, I do wonder at one stage, does someone raise the question, well, is actually is deliberately creating market impact a breach of the principles of the global code? And I don't think we've had that debate yet. And I think at some stage we may well do so.
Speaking of debates, you were telling me recently that you had some interesting feedback regarding what constitutes full amount trading.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and speaking of market impact, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, again,
I always thought full amount just meant the full amount that you want to do.
So did I. But once again, the clever inverted commas people out there have managed to bastardize the English language and make it mean something different from this, from the people that bought you pre-hedging. So basically, I mean, it's been going on for a couple of years, but we went to this stage where everyone's going, oh, yeah, break every trade down into, like, the smallest possible amount and just very gently feed it into the market. The fact is, every time you enter any market in a digital fashion, you leave a digital footprint. Somebody will pick it up. And if you're trading in smaller amounts, then ultimately someone's going to pick up the fact that, yeah, this is the fourth or fifth time or even the tenth time this guy has sold 1 or 2 million units, and they've probably got another 80 to go. So this sort of model was kind of found out, I guess. I mean, it wasn't totally, but it was kind of found out. It was creating market impact again. There was slippage and signaling risk was involved. So the answer was, well, I've got to do my 100. And as you say, 100 full amount. There you go. Could I have a price in 100, please? Let's make it 200. make it bigger. Pricing 200. They don't do that. What they do now is they go, I'll break it down into clips of 20, but I will only trade the 20 with one LP. Therefore, it will be full amount for now. So I guess what these guys are saying is, yeah, I'm going to go hit your stream in 20. I'm going to give you time to internalize that risk or exit that risk. Then I'm going to hit you another 20, and I'll give you the same length of time, and I'm going to hit you another 20, and so on and so forth. So effectively, it comes down to 10 clips. Now, the challenge for me is that when you have somebody repeatedly hitting, it comes down to how long does it take the LP to absorb that 20 million. Now, if they can internalize it, does it take 3 to 4 seconds? Does it take 20 seconds? According to market conditions and currency pair, it would be totally different. But you've got some clients out there saying, yeah, full amount in 20, yours, full amount in 20, yours, full amount in 20, yours, in that sort of time frame. And the LP just doesn't have time to get out of it. So to me, that doesn't constitute full amount trading.
Yeah, not sure it does to my mind either.
No. And the other thing is, they actually, so you can sit and say, well, the LP will then go, well, okay, I know this guy's not giving me enough time to get out of the risk. So therefore, I'm skewing my price, or I'm going to widen my price for the next clip. And then the customer goes, okay, well, he's got a wider price, or he's not the best price in the market. I'm going to go and do it with somebody else. So all of a sudden, you've got the double whammy of not only is it not full amount, but it's not even full amount to you. Somebody else is now getting it full amount, inverted commas. And to me, that's kind of like, that's tiptoeing into, I don't think it's deliberately trying to gain an advantage. I think it's a genuine attempt to achieve best execution and to find that happy balance between a risk transfer price that is too wide and clips that are too small and they'll create signaling risk. I think it's a genuine attempt to do that. I just don't like the idea of them calling it full amount trading because it's not truthful. I think there needs to be a much more detailed conversation between client and LP around, okay, so if I'm hitting you in euro dollar at 2:30 p.m. in London, how long is it going to take you? 3 seconds. If I'm hitting you in 20 million at 2:30 p.m. New York, it's going to take you a lot longer. And if you get into Asia, probably even longer. And I think we need to sort of, you know, at some stage, I think, and again, the GFXC is looking at disclosures this week and they're reporting on disclosures. I wonder whether we need to look at it in terms of the disclosures around, okay, there's full amount trading and there's full amount clips. That,
yeah.
Anytime we introduce a grey area, we're just opening ourselves up to, you know, conflict. And, you know, conflict between LP and LC is a natural part of any market, but it kind of bugs me. And I got quite a lot of feedback from people saying, yeah, it's, you know, they said it's open to abuse on both sides because, you know, say the LP suddenly starts externalizing and the customer goes, well, hang on a second, I'm dealing with you because you're a big internalizer and now I'm seeing market impact. And then the LP says, yeah, but you're not giving me enough time to get out of this risk. And the customer's thinking, well, I'm giving you 20 seconds. How much longer do you need? And the LP goes, yeah. Well, you know, this is the problem. And we have this he said, she said scenario.
Yeah, yeah.
Where nobody actually knows. Luckily, we're now in a world where we have the data that enables us to more accurately see what happens around an execution. I don't think it tells the whole story still, but there is definitely the opportunity there to use the data to maybe just turn around and disabuse some of these notions that, you know, oh, they're abusing me. No, you're abusing me. No, I'm abusing. No, it's just does my head in. Like so many things. Interestingly, on Matters Code, you wrote this week about a code of conduct, and it's an issue that's come up at our conferences, and it come up on the block conferences in Chicago. A code of conduct for the digital markets. What's that about?
Yeah, so it was interesting. In Chicago, we actually had a session on do we need the equivalent to the FX Global Code for the crypto market. Really interesting session. I would say, sort of trying to sum it up, we got quite in depth, but trying to sum it up briefly was, does it need it? Yes. Would it be helpful? Yes. Is implementing one going to be realistic right now? Almost certainly not. For a variety of reasons, and I'll kind of get into some of them as we just go through. So what's happened is a group of firms have got together to create the Association for Digital Asset Markets, or ADAM, and they're trying to establish a code of conduct for emerging digital asset markets.
Sorry, I've just got to interrupt you there, mate. Can they get together with the new version of WNBA, which is Evia?
EVM.
Adam and
Oh
Evia.
my God, I hadn't even thought of that.
Anyway, carry on.
We got to have them on a panel at some stage together. So it's a bunch of firms, and most of the firms who are kind of listed on here, they're US based, but there's some kind of, heavy hitters within the space there. And it's they're planning to work together with current and former regulators to provide rules for efficient trading, custody, clearing, and settlement of digital assets. Now, let me be clear. This is definitely a good initiative. It's definitely a worthy initiative. The crypto space could definitely do with just some guidelines outlining what is and isn't appropriate and professional hate behavior, because a lot of it is still the Wild West out there. There's a few problems, right? Which is to think about how much trouble and how much talk we've had about the FX Global Code, like how do you give it teeth, right? And that's when you have central authorities like central banks who are there to cajole, encourage, promote, etc., the global code, right? Now, the whole point about digital assets and kind of the crypto space, right? There is no central authority, right?
No.
Like who do you have trying to promote and push this? This is a group of US-based firms. There's already actually another initiative being headed up by Jeff Bansman, formerly of the CFTC, who's doing a global code, supposedly, with a whole new different group of participants. So much of the trading activity happens worldwide. I think there's no mention of Asia or Asia-based firms on here. So much of the, still, a lot of the market is either small or retail trading activity. So how do you get this out to them? I don't know who enforces it. I don't know how it has teeth. Like, beyond being like a nice and worthy initiative, I don't really see how it's gonna have any impact. And of the firms signed up to, I'm just looking at the list. I don't see any platforms, for example, on this
No.
list. It's more kind of trading firms and brokerages, really.
The only thing I would say on it is you use the word, and I think you quoted someone. You use the word rules. I'm not hearing codes of conduct in rules. I'm hearing attempts at regulation, self-regulation. That's an interesting one for me, because I think the minute you get into the word rules, in which the US do like to get into, obviously, because it's quite a heavily regulated financial market system, but you kind of get Asia to turn off then. And like, well, we don't really need rules, and your point about retail is very good. And where I think it could work is if they can actually establish really good framework for saying, okay, this is what we believe. Your onboarding KYC AML policy should be. This is the standard of bookkeeping and record keeping that we expect you to keep. Beyond that, I think you're right. I mean, it becomes really difficult unless, of course, they can get to the stage where they can become worthy enough that it becomes, particularly for bigger traders, not the retail. I don't think the retail will ever come in. But for bigger traders, they turn around and say, actually, I'm going to trade with one of these firms that has signed up this code of conduct, because at least I then know how they should be behaving. You can get this, this peer pressure may come to bear.
So what I think this could well be, looking at especially the list of firms that have signed up, is kind of it's kind of an early pitch for the institutional money that a lot of people are hoping coming into the space. Because if you're an institutional player, you're looking around, you say, okay, you'll ask anyone on the street who are the biggest players. They'll name, a bunch of people who've signed up to this code, and then you look around and you say, okay, so what are the market standards for trading, custody, clearing, and settlement? And then there's one group who says, hey, we have this published list of standards and guidelines that we are committed to adhering to versus everybody else, you're going to immediately gravitate to those people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what they're kind of hoping with the FX Global Code, and I think that's why the banks all signed up for that. And one thing I would point out, actually, is that if you look at the FX Global Code, it doesn't actually apply to retail. It's actually for wholesale market participants only. So you can have a code of conduct for the for one segment of the market and not the other. That can work. For me, I guess the challenge is, and you know more about this than I do, but it strikes me that there's probably more retail flow in crypto than there is institutional at the moment, and that's the opposite to FX. In FX, the senior market is undoubtedly wholesale. At the moment in crypto, is the senior market retail?
It's definitely still retail. But, I mean, it's difficult to know. I mean, everybody talks about institutionalization. Everyone talks like there's this big wave of institutional money waiting to come into the market. And they could well be right. And if they are kind of right on this bet, then, we could see a shift, let's say, in the next 5 to 6 years where that reverses, particularly if the price keeps going down and retail punters lose money and lose interest. But it could be the case that institutional money doesn't end up coming in droves, and it does remain retail driven for a while. It's not clear quite yet how that's going to play out. But yes, you're certainly right. At the moment, it's still the vast majority of flows are retail.
Yeah, I mean, I guess on the sort of crypto thing, you posted something this week ahead of an event you're moderating on Tuesday in New York. Does the price action of cryptos tell the whole story? Because I sort of look at it and think, well, okay, so the price has gone down. Prices do go down. It happens. If we're naive enough to think that an asset just keeps on going up, then we deserve to get our backsides handed to us on a plate once in a while. What are you going to be talking about on this session on Tuesday around this sort of the price of cryptos? What are you looking for from your speakers?
Well, there's a few things. So first of all, we're starting off with a fireside chat with Daniel Gorfein, the Chief Innovation Officer and the Director of Lab CFTC. That's their kind of fintech innovation arm of CFTC. So I'd be really interested to hear, firstly, his take on the space, what kind of things they're focused on, what they're looking at. Well, I think the crypto code of conduct is certainly something we'll be discussing with him.
Yes.
And it's difficult for regulators. I actually think, by and large, they've done a good job thus far of walking that line between, making sure that there aren't bad actors ripping off, particularly kind of mum and pup in the market, but also allowing, innovation, allowing this market to develop and flourish. I suspect it's difficult sometimes. But,
I think it's easier for them in this case because they do have a good framework in the retail fiat markets.
Yes.
To build off. I think, if this had come at them with a heavily institutionalized market, a globally institutionalized market, it might be a bit more difficult. But I think you're right. I mean, it seems to me that they've learned lessons before, and frankly, the CFTC regime now is more reasonable to markets, in my view, than the previous regime. But,
So the theme for the session is called Looking for Liquidity, and it's kind of looking at liquidity trends. I mean, and obviously now we'll particularly be looking at it in light of this bear market that we've seen. And so I guess, one of the questions will be, the extent to which, we've seen, as we talk about the title, does the price action tell the whole story? I mean, for all the negative price action, the bear market we've seen, fundamentals in some way have been improving. There was a big hard fork issue that got resolved recently. We've had ICE and NASDAQ both planning to launch crypto trading platforms next year, which is kind of a boost to the institutional development of it. Fidelity is launching its asset custody service. While there has been this bear market, actually in the last month, in November in particular, volumes and liquidity on the CME and CBOE futures have actually been trending up significantly. There's still ETF proposals sitting on U.S. regulators' desks. If that gets approved, it's a massive boost. So it could, it, honestly, it, I'd be interested to hear the speaker's comments on this, but it could just be that what we're seeing now is as the retail liquidity is drying up, institutional liquidity is actually edging closer than ever, and that this kind of just marks the next evolution of this market.
I would agree totally. I mean, I made the point to Julie last week in this podcast that to me, as a, if I had a trading house, I don't care what the price level is. I just care that it's moving. Because if I'm just going to sit there and have this thing just not move, to me, there was a bigger threat to the crypto market last month when nothing was happening, you know, I mean, relatively speaking. And I know it works for certain strategies, but, you know, if I'm an investor-type trader, I want movement. And, yeah, that'll be interesting to hear what they say on that.
So it's funny. One of the speakers we've got is the CEO of a hedge fund, a CTA in New York. And I don't think I'm giving away anything too much from the session to say. I spoke to him on a pre-panel call just the other day, and I mean, he pretty much said word for word what you said, where he said, you know, our models don't really. He said, we love it. We're finding good alpha. We're getting good returns. I don't care if it goes up or down, day or night, as long as it's moving. As long as
it goes somewhere.
But he's like, the price has been trending down the last few months, and he's like, and we've made really good money. They were up, you know, like 17% for the last month or something. He's finding that his models are working really well and doesn't care about the actual underlying price, and he's very bullish on the whole thing going forward.
Well, I mean, and that's fair enough. I mean, because I think, let's face it, it's. I think, again, we're falling into the trap of looking at crypto as being a long-only asset, and it's not.
It's a bit of perspective, right? I mean, like this compared to this time last year, it's been a huge collapse, right? Although obviously it was a big bubble.
Yeah.
But like compared to the start of 2007, if you told me at the very beginning, January 1st, 2017, that crypto was going to be at, you know, what is it, 3,600, 4,000, I would have been like, that's crazy.
Yeah. There you go.
So,
welcome to the world of market.
You do need a bit of perspective on these things, and it just looks like it depends on what kind of time horizon you're looking at this on. So that event is taking place in New York at the Princeton Club. It's just 4:30 to 7:30, so we just do these two sessions, and there's networking drinks. It's free to attend. It's only open to trading firms and investors, though. But if you are interested in attending, feel free to drop me a note, drop me a line. I'm pretty easy to find, but if not, my email is just Galen, G-A-L-E-N, at profit-loss.com.
And on that note, the outrageous plug. No, sadly, I'm flying out of New York on, because we're actually both in the same country again, but I'm flying out on Sunday morning. But, should be a good event. We're going to leave it there this week. Thanks for listening. As always, if you've got any questions or feedback, you can hit us up on email or Twitter. Have a very good week, and we'll be back next week. Thanks very much for listening.